In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Plenty coming your way this hour. Iowa GOP Chair Jeff Kaufman due to join us live in the second half hour. Also coming up later in this first half hour, election law scholar Derek Muller of the University of Iowa gives us his thoughts on the wide-ranging elections law bill we've been hearing about in our news that may reach the Iowa governor's desk today or this week. Before that, let's catch up quickly on some state sports news with Mark Emmert, Iowa Hawkeyes beat reporter for the Des Moines Register and the Iowa City Press Citizen. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. Let's talk about this record-setting Sunday. The Hawkeyes' Luka Garza became the leading scorer in Iowa men's basketball history. That was a game on Sunday against Penn State, passing Roy Marble. You call him consistently brilliant for the past two seasons. What makes him such a brilliant player?
Well, I think it starts, Ben, with his hard work. I mean, I'm not sure I've ever been around an athlete that works harder than Luka Garza, because he's not an elite athlete, and he knows that. So he makes up for it with his grueling workouts in the summer. He's always adding different elements to his game to make sure that he can be unguardable and also, you know, have the stamina to play, you know, 35 minutes a night against some really, really big muscular guys that are trying to knock him around a little bit. And he holds up very well in there. So work ethic starts. I mean, he's a skilled guy, certainly is a really, really good offensive player. And, you know, he's just relentless. I mean, he really is determined to get his points no matter what happens. And the team knows that. They feed him the ball and they get him in, you know, good scoring positions. But I think it all really stems from that work ethic. And it's really unlike anything I've ever seen, because he took a big leap between his sophomore and junior year. I mean, he's averaging 10 points a game more than he was. And that, you just don't see that usually at this level. I mean, he's just been taking a huge step forward, and it's night in and night out. He's like, one thing you can count on in college basketball is Luka Garza is probably going to get 20 points at least every game.
Iowa ranked 14, I think you wrote, 16-6 record, fourth in the Big Ten Conference. What's it been like in this really odd COVID Hawkeye basketball season?
Yeah, they've actually moved up to 12th now. This the poll came out yesterday, but yeah, it has been unusual because there's no fans allowed in Big Ten arenas this year, and a lot of places not even the parents. Iowa is allowing parents in, so you usually have a few hundred people sitting across. You know, they're across from us, but there's some noise there, but. You know, if you go to arenas like we were at Wisconsin last week, there was basically nobody in there, and they were piping in crowd noise. It was actually really loud crowd noise, but it was just so odd. It was like, it wasn't even like matching up what was going on during the game. It was like just suddenly there'd be like a lot of crowd noise, and then like nothing was going on. It's like, what is this? It's so surreal almost.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you're not around the players or the coaches. Obviously, we do every post game is over Zoom. So we haven't had any contact with anybody, you know, personally all year in terms of Iowa basketball, which is, you know, unusual. Usually we get a lot of access to those guys and we can kind of actually have conversations, and it's almost more of a, you know, relaxed, informal atmosphere. Now it's just everything feels like a press conference, you're grilling them and you have to take turns asking questions, and it's just different. I understand why it has to be this way. There's no question. I'm not blaming anybody that it does have to be this way for their safety, but it's a year unlike anything else for sure.
A quick word about postseason. Will there be a March Madness? This NCAA tournament is a big moneymaker. What does the postseason look like for the UI?
Yeah, there's going to be one. They've made sure of that all along. That's been the goal all season for every team, every league, is to make sure they get to March Madness, because you're right, that's where all the money comes from. That basically funds the entire NCAA for a year. And so not having one last year has really been crippling in that aspect. I mean, Iowa itself lost $3.5 million last year out of its athletic budget just because of March Madness. So you can see what that means to pretty much every school in the country. So there will be one. They're going to have the whole thing in Indianapolis, and it's going to be basically kind of a almost like a bubble atmosphere. The players will be sequestered in their hotels. They each have to have their own room. They won't be able to have their meals in there. They're really going to be very strict about making sure those guys don't don't get out and mingle with the public. And so that's going to be different. But they will have a tournament, I'm sorry. And the Big Ten tournament is there in 2 weeks, and also in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And I will be at both. Iowa should have a very good seed in the NCAA tournament, probably the best seed they've had, you know, in the last 20 years or so. And, you know, they're expected to be one of the contenders. I mean, they are a team that could actually make a run all the way to the Final Four. They've got that much talent. So big week for them this week. They play at Michigan and at Ohio State. Those are two of the top five teams in the country. So we'll get a really good idea of whether Iowa can match up with that kind of, you know, talent. But they are really well positioned right now. They should have a very, very, very good March.
Let's spend a little time on the University of Iowa swimming. In the face of a legal challenge claiming gender discrimination, the university, the UI, announced this week it's backing off a decision to cut the women's swimming team. Iowa Athletic Director Gary Barta made this decision. Well, he actually cut not only the women's, decided back in August, the UI men's and women's swimming and diving team, as well as gymnastics. With this backtracking, this backing off the decision, give us the reason here. Why the reversal?
Well, four of the women swimmers filed a lawsuit, a Title IX lawsuit, as you mentioned, in federal court. And the judge, there was a hearing, and the judge was seemed very favorable to their side. And she issued an injunction saying, Iowa, you cannot cut this sport until this thing gets all the way through court, which that could take months, could take years. Really, what happened is Iowa realized they were going to lose that lawsuit. I mean, they that's just flat out. That's happened everywhere around the country. Any of these cases that go to court always end up the university losing. You've seen a lot of schools now backing off those plans. I think Dartmouth just did that recently, and then also asked their athletic director to resign as a result. So cutting a women's sports program really, really brings a lot of scrutiny to a school to make sure they're in compliance with Title IX. And I think Iowa was out of compliance. That's what the lawyer was going to argue. And so basically, I don't know that he had much of a choice here. It was kind of a hasty decision to cut a women's sport to begin with. A lot of schools did not take that step. Only Iowa and Michigan State decided to do that in the Big Ten. And Michigan State is also facing a Title IX lawsuit over trying to cut women's swimming. So we'll see what happens with that one. But they were going to lose. And now the question is, do they have to actually add a women's sport? Are they so far out of compliance that Iowa really has to create a new women's sport opportunity? And if they did, it might be women's wrestling, which I think would be very well received in the state. So stay tuned on that one. That could be the next thing to happen.
Mm-hmm. Still the men's gymnastics, men's swimming, and diving, men's tennis programs, they are still cut. This doesn't affect them.
That is correct. There's still a group that's very active out there trying to get them reinstated. They're raising money, trying to get a meeting with the university to find a funding model going forward for that. So that's still pending, but Gary Barta said that decision is final. And of course, there's no lawsuit there because that's not a Title IX issue. I mean, you can cut a men's sport if you're an athletic director. You know, whether it's wise to do that or not, you know, from a public relations standpoint is a different question. But for now, that still stands.
In the final minute, Mark, let's zoom out a little bit. The Big Ten originally canceled its season for football. Then they played. Iowa canceled the UI women's swimming and diving. Now that's back. Does this call into question Iowa athletic leadership?
Well, certainly the latter one does. I mean, the football situation was out of their hands. That was a Big Ten decision. But, the swimming, I mean, he's obviously lost a lawsuit, a very high-profile lawsuit just 4 years ago over gender discrimination issues. And so if you talk to anybody nationally, that's one question that always comes up is how does he still have a job? Because you don't see athletic directors typically getting in this much legal trouble repeatedly. And he's also facing a lawsuit over alleged racial discrimination on the football team. So that's still in federal court. So, you know, it's a great question with a new president coming on board, what Gary Barta's future is. But I think he must be asking the same question because, you know, it certainly is a fraught with peril right now. Just the kind of the position he's put himself in with some of the decisions that he's made.
Okay. Thank you for a sports update, Mark Emmert, Iowa Hawkeyes beat reporter for the Des Moines Register and the Iowa City Press Citizen. Mark, take care. We'll look forward to the next update.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, Republicans in the Iowa legislature quickly advancing a wide-ranging elections bill. We've been hearing about that in the news. Lawmakers planning to send the bill to the governor's desk as early as today. Let's get analysis of this and some other things in state elections law. Derek Muller is with us, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. He specializes in election law. Derek, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about what's happening in the Iowa legislature. This is a fast hustle there. Republicans in the Iowa legislature advancing this elections bill, to name a few things that it does, shrinking the early voting and voting by mail period from 29 to 18 days. It ends so-called county rule, home rule powers regarding elections, proposes criminal penalties for election officials who don't comply with state directives, among a number of other measures. How do you see this bill? This is really a fast and furious whole bunch of things, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think whenever you look at an omnibus bill like this that has a little bit of everything, I think you're going to go through it and you're going to see some things that make sense or some things that are maybe not as well founded. And I think a lot of times it comes down on points of view or wondering about, are there problems with the current system? And if so, are they addressed here? Or are they adding some complexity? So on a couple of the points you mentioned, right, I think that there is a case to be made of increasing uniformity in the treatment of the elections across the state. And I understand why county auditors are opposed to that. They like to have some more discretion and flexibility. But at the same time, I think we saw some problems in the last election about disparate treatment across counties or different decisions that auditors made that had to be reversed by courts on appeal. So I think increasing uniformity is beneficial. There is a downside to that, but it provides something. On the flip side, as you point out, shortening the early voting and absentee periods, I think Iowa has had a more generous policy on early voting. I think that would come down closer to average, if not slightly below average, at 18 days. But on the absentee side, I'm not aware of any state in the country that has a period as short as that doesn't allow you to mail absentee ballots until 18 days before the election. And so that would be one of the more remarkable shortenings in the bill, as I see it.
Right. And the rationale, I think I read for that would be, well, Iowans are sick of such long campaigns, which this does nothing to fix, right?
Well, yeah, the campaign will never get shorter, that's for sure. Under federal law, overseas voters are required to have their absentee ballots mailed 45 days before the election. So that already is starting there. And of course, I imagine we'll start seeing some people touring the state of Iowa in the very near future for 2024. So it's going to be difficult to shorten the absentee ballot period. That said, I do understand a different sentiment of the concern of, if people want to change their minds, we don't want them getting their absentee ballots so early that then they regret their decision. But, I think that's an empirical question. And most of the people who vote extremely early are pretty locked into their preferences. They're pretty excited about one thing or another, and there's very little that's going to change their mind.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a couple of voices for and against this bill. Racing through the legislature. Last night, there was a legislative public hearing on these proposed changes to election law. Here's Emily Russell, a law student, articulating why she supports this bill, arguing that ballot harvesting will become a widespread issue and undermine election integrity.
As someone who has dealt with various political organizations over the years, the concept of ballot harvesting is very unsettling to me. Political parties, campaigns, and special interest groups should never be trusted to collect and return a voter's ballot. If that doesn't raise red flags in your head, then you aren't paying attention to the state of our current political climate. This bill would eliminate ballot harvesting, as I said, which gives me peace of mind because I know firsthand what special interest groups are capable of doing in order to get the result they seek, and many of them do not care how they get there, just as long as they do get there. So I'm in support of this bill.
Okay, let's hear another voice in opposition to that one during last night's public hearing on election law. Janice Weiner, she's a city council member from Iowa City, spoke in opposition to these bills. She argued it will suppress certain groups' access to vote and that Iowa's last election went extremely well.
In the midst of a pandemic, Iowans voted in record numbers. 75.77% of those eligible voted. That's awesome. Secretary of State Pate congratulated us. Our aim should be to overtake Minnesota, where nearly 80% of eligible voters voted, not roll things back. Shortening the absentee window will disadvantage shut-ins, snowbirds, domestic violence victims, the elderly, many in rural areas, and more. And taking people off the voter rolls for missing one general election is unconscionable. Our laws are not broken. There was no fraud. You are public servants who serve all Iowans. Just as Senator Ernst won her election and each of you won yours, President Biden won freely and fairly. The remedy for the big lie of a stolen election is not to take an axe to election laws that work exceedingly well. It's simply to tell the truth.
Two voices from a legislative public hearing held last night on Iowa's proposed changes to election law. I don't know how much of this hearing you caught, Derek, but what's your reaction to those two voices and any others you saw?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it reflects, a couple of different sort of threads that seem to be resonating throughout the United States right now. On the one hand are sort of concerns and allegations about fraud, and there's no question that there are isolated instances where that's happened. North Carolina congressional district in 2018 is a famous recent example of ballot harvesting, of collecting ballots and then essentially altering them or filling them out for voters and then casting them. Again, it's rare, but it does occur. On the flip side is, the consideration, do you want to enact a 40-page statute to address these things and offer a series of changes that can add complexity and uncertainty to the process and might, adversely affect some voters going forward and wondering what the impact of that is going to look like. So, I think it's some speculation about the future, what's the risk of future fraud and the risk of future disenfranchisement. And those are, I think passionate arguments coming out in the public debate.
Mm-hmm. To finish up on this in a few words, this is going to happen. This will be Iowa's new law. There's nothing stopping it, is there?
Well, I think there will be litigation after that. I think there are a handful of provisions that are going to be vulnerable to litigation, the shortening the absentee window, the ballot harvesting definition might be exceedingly narrow, the signature requirements might be too onerous. There's a few things that I would be looking at for future litigation.
Okay. Before we say goodbye to you, Derek, update us on this contested congressional race in Iowa's 2nd District. A reminder, this is one of the closest federal elections in recent history. Some 400,000 votes were cast. Democrat Rita Hart formally contesting her 6-vote loss. Now, some things happened at the end of last week. Where do things stand now?
Right. So Rita Hart filed a petition in Congress asking essentially for Congress to count some additional ballots that she claims were improperly excluded, or in the alternative for the House to conduct a new recount on its own. And that in either scenario, she would be the winner. And so Representative Marionette Miller-Meeks was sworn in. But there's this contest that's still pending. So she's voting and participating in Congress, but we're waiting to see what happens. So the Committee on House Administration is a congressional committee that handles these things. And it has a motion to dismiss that was filed by Representative Miller-Meeks. The Hart campaign had filed a response to that, a resistance motion. And right now it's just sort of sitting in committee. And in a couple of weeks, I anticipate, is when the committee is going to get back together and decide how to proceed, whether to dismiss it or whether to start conducting discovery, to start asking the parties about, asking Representative Miller-Meeks to answer that complaint and then potentially start digging into some of the evidence of the ballots cast here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So if you refuse to dismiss, and how long is this process? How much sort of oxygen will it take out of the air in the U.S. House? How much do you expect national attention will it get?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the open question, right? There are instances in the past where it has dismissed these complaints quickly. There are a number of instances in recent memory where it hasn't dismissed it. It's gone to discovery, to looking at some of the evidence, and then issuing a report later to say, we find that, the representative is entitled to remain in her seat. It's been decades since Congress has ousted someone who's been seated, with somebody else. So it's sort of an open question about how long they want to take and how thorough they want to investigate. I suggested on your program some time ago, I would anticipate it would take about 6 months, but at this point it could also take longer if they choose not to dismiss. They don't seem in a rush at the moment.
Mm-hmm. In these contested ballots, is it 20-some ballots? How do you evaluate those and the way in which they were declared improper and not counted?
Yeah, this is, I think, an interesting question, and I think a major source of dispute between the parties. On the one hand, under Iowa law, They were excluded by panels, or they were, they lacked the chain of custody to indicate that they were, validly cast at the time. And there might have been a mechanism had Hart filed a contest in the Iowa courts to challenge those things and to get those included. But because that process was not followed, it goes straight to Congress. And now Congress has to make a judgment. Congress needs to say Iowa got it wrong. If we're looking at Iowa law, here's what Iowa courts would have done. Or they could be even more aggressive and say we're going to ignore Iowa law and do what we think is right. So it can be a context-specific inquiry looking at whether or not these ballots actually complied with Iowa law. And that's a judgment for Congress to make.
Technical difficulties. Can you hear me still?
I hear you with a little bit of an echo, but I am hearing you.
Okay, very good. What position does this put lawmakers as the under Speaker Pelosi?
Yeah, I think, Congress is moving slowly on this, and it's going to be on the Committee of House Administration to make a decision before referring a full report to Congress, including Speaker Pelosi. So Democrats hold a very narrow majority, and so I think they want to make sure that whatever decision they reach is going to be supportable by, obviously the overwhelming majority of their caucus. But at the same time, these are often not raw partisan disputes. There's usually bipartisan agreement to dismiss or to conclude that the contestant should remain in her seat. So I think that there's some likelihood that it might not result in something overly controversial if there's agreement. I think the problem arises if we start to sort of veer into some more of the partisanship, where Democrats are thinking one thing and Republicans thinking another. But until we see more of this play out in terms of the facts and the law and the arguments being made within this committee, I don't think we're going to have a good sense of what Congress is going to do then.
Mm-hmm. In 30 seconds, we had a census year last year. Redistricting, of course, complicated by the pandemic. Mm-hmm. You have your eyes on redistricting, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be delayed. I think most states have that delay because there's problems in the census from the outgoing administration coupled with the pandemic. But I think in Iowa, it's usually historically been a relatively low-key process. There's a number of legal constraints on redistricting that make it difficult for too much egregious or controversial to occur. But that said, we'll wait and see what happens.
Okay, thank you very much. Derek Mueller, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Thanks for the update, Derek.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, Iowa GOP Chair Jeff Kaufman joins us live in the second half hour to discuss where the Republican Party, with all the infighting, is, where it's headed, and what role Donald Trump should play in it. That's when we return with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.